It's cold here in Sharon, very chilly, but not as chilly as it is for some people in merry old England. they had their election and a crushing defeat. Good morning there, David.
Good morning. It's David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat here from London just recently. I'm actually calling you from New York, but I was in my old home country to survey. Well, I was doing lots of things, but part of my task was to survey the mood of the country. And it's interesting. The pollsters said at the last moment that they were able to poll, because Britain has this rule that opinion polls have to end 2 days before the actual election so as to be less likely to influence it. The polls at the last moment available to them were predicting something like a 28-seat majority for Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party in the new parliament that was returned in this general election. The exit polls on the night, last night, in England and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland were predicting something more like an astonishing 68-seat majority. And then when it comes down to it now that we're getting actual results in for almost a totality of all the 600-plus seats in Parliament, we now see that, practically speaking, it'll probably be in about the 40s. But whatever the actual number, it is a resounding victory for Boris Johnson, Bojo, as our colleague Jill likes to call him, and some Brits also call him that too, not particularly friendly. There he is. He's got the most resounding majority that the Conservatives have had since the days of Margaret Thatcher. And the Labour Party on the opposite side of the aisle, as it were, in Parliament, have been reduced humiliatingly. They've suffered the worst defeat in a general election since the 1930s, 80 years ago. So quite a blow, an extraordinary historic happening in this general election, which the Prime Minister himself says that he didn't want to call, but it has served his interests very well to call it, and it's turned out very, very well for him.
By the way, I didn't do the proper intro for David. Of course, that's his own website, themediabeat.us.
I just popped up, and here I am, yes.
and he's a PBS television correspondent as well. Now, the reason I wanted to get to this right away, because...
You were so eager to get to this, I can tell.
Very eager, because within that election result, okay, there's an 800-pound gorilla sitting to the north, and that is really an indication of, I think, big troubles to come for Bojo and for everybody, because it really looks like now independence is going to be back on the front burner.
North of the border, you're talking about Scotland, a separate nation. It's not called a United Kingdom lightly. The United Kingdom since the 18th century has meant a combination of different countries. England predominantly, that has always been the richest and most powerful element, but not the exclusive one, and not one that is, you know, duty bound or nature bound to lead. And that's the sense of grievance that many people north of the border and west of the Welsh border feel. Scottish and Welsh nationalism are strong forces and have become stronger over the years. Scottish nationalism got its boost a couple of decades ago and has been its first electoral boosted, and they now have their own parliament as of almost 30 years now. And the party which is strongest in favor of most things autonomous, right down to foreign relations being a matter for Scotland alone, a separate place in the world, that's promoted by the Scottish National Party. nationalists, and the nationalists have been given a great boost by this election. They are now undoubtedly the biggest party in Scotland, resoundingly so, mainly at the expense, well, at the expense of all three other parties in Scotland. The ruling Conservative Party are very thinly represented in Scotland now. Labour, which did have a residual power base there, very substantial, but now shamingly diminished. And even the small moderate left, if you like, Liberal Democratic Party, which is a UK-wide party, but its leader had a seat in Scotland. She lost her seat in Scotland. She now has no place in Parliament. So she, as well as Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, are having to step down. In the case of the Lib Dem leader, she's doing so because she doesn't have a seat in Parliament anymore and therefore can't lead a party. And Jeremy Corbyn, simply because he has suffered such a resounding loss. So, yes, everything's tumultuously changed. In Scotland, I think the change is very significant, as you said. And one of the inevitable consequences of this, Boris Johnson will attempt to stand in his way, but the Scottish National Party, who are now ruling the roost north of the border, have a very strong argument and will press it remorselessly for saying that, hey, we're being dragged out of Europe, because the main issue of this election, of course, was Brexit, the leaving by the United Kingdom of the European out of the European Union, and Scotland resoundingly, whenever the opportunity has been offered to them, has voted consistently to stay in Europe, and at the same time, This buttresses and supports the argument for independence. The Scots are saying to the English, you're dragging us out of Europe. We want to stay in. Here's another argument for us leaving the United Kingdom and ultimately rejoining the European as a Scottish nation alone.
Now, how long is it going to take for them to put this to a vote again?
To put Europe to a vote again, that's now regarded as a done deal. That argument is over. January of this coming year, just a month away from now, Boris Johnson is in a position to write the legislation taking Britain out of Europe. The other question, the question of Scotland's independence, the starting pistol has been fired. The Scots want it immediately. Well, not immediately, but realistically speaking, within the next 2 years is what they've been planning on. And of course, as I say, Boris Johnson will try and prevent that happening. But it will be a classic Scotland versus London argument that will only, of course, I'm predicting this, I think I'm right, only rebound to the Scottish nationalists' own benefit, to see Prime Minister in London trying to block the will of the Scottish people is a guarantee that you'll get more and more angry Scots.
And you'll get more and more votes to separate. Yeah, you're right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's so. It's you know, the old term, elections have consequences.
Absolutely. And if you switch to another aspect of the United Kingdom, one which we've talked in this slot about many times as Brexit has been bubbling along, or volcanically preparing to explode, and here is the explosion. In Northern Ireland, the effect of this election has been, for the first time ever, to produce a majority of Westminster Parliament seats representing that part of the United Kingdom to be occupied by by nationalists. Again, that word nationalism, you know, this whole thing has been an argument about sovereignty in different directions, English nationalism, Scottish nationalism, and a very long-standing Irish nationalism in the island of Ireland and in the northern part of that island, which is still, since 1921, considered, with a border drawn across the island of Ireland, to be part of the UK. Now you have a majority of its parliamentary seats occupied by people who want to join Southern Ireland. So the Brexit issue has become a hugely sharp wedge issue for Northern Ireland too. So the United Kingdom, which Boris Johnson has so resoundingly been voted the chief executive of, now is facing really major threats to that very unity of the United, so-called United Kingdom.
Now, looking at the majority he has, one would say that there's very little that can knock him out of power in the next several years unless something disastrous happens with Scotland and Northern Ireland.
That's true. That's a pretty rock-solid majority. The big majority that preceded it for the Conservatives a long time ago now, but in the 1970s, lasting through to the 1990s, the Thatcher years, we think of them as, although towards the end it was another prime minister who succeeded her, John Major. But at that time, it effectively, their large majority effectively insulated them against being threatened by a Labour Party. In some eyes for the Labour Party, that was the real wilderness years. The Labour Party was out of power for 17 years. And I'm not predicting that anything like that is going to be the consequence of this election, but it's certainly very serious. The Labour Party is now down and very nearly out. Something very dramatic has got to change for them to be able to present any form of effective parliamentary opposition to the supremacist kind of leadership that Boris Johnson is now about to take up.
All right, when we get back to the beginning of the conversation about this, by the way, it's David Terechuk, and this is the Media Beat. The press, it appeared the press there once again read the pulse, I think, of the nation a little wrong. Where did things go wrong with the press there?
It constantly happens. The prediction I was mentioning that was closest to the truth was from a polling organization. And of course, you know, the media's predictions are all based on polling companies' efforts. I mean, you can't gauge the public pulse by sending a reporter out on the road, although it's a very useful adjunct to judging the public mood. I think it's very important to do. But the scientific way of trying to gauge how public opinion as a body is shifting is a very complex exercise, and the one organization which seemed to get it more right than wrong, I'm afraid during the last election, the Theresa May election, and the Brexit referendum itself, the pollsters of Britain were shown to be very, very off beam, and it's been proven true again. Even the organization that, as I say, it's called YouGov, and it has a particular very, very sophisticated mathematical model for conducting this exercise, engaging public opinion. But even it got it wrong. It said there would be a substantial majority, but nowhere near what it, predicted roughly half the size of the majority that the Conservatives have ended up getting. It's a very complicated business, as pollsters themselves would be the first to admit, if they're being honest. I think what's happened is that there's a huge degree of voter fatigue in Britain now. And when you go out, I mean, the fundamental, however let me start again. However sophisticated your mathematical model may be, and however huge the sample is, you know, as indeed YouGov's sample is enormous compared with the others, you still are confronted with one fundamental potential flaw at the heart of all polling, which is that the individual members of the public that you ask the questions of may not tell you the truth. And indeed, that does seem to lie at the heart of the fragility and erratic nature sometimes of pollsters' predictions. In this case, as I say, the sense of British voter fatigue with all the elections we've been having and all the sterile frozen political logjam we've had for the last 3 years is something that has just exhausted the British public, I believe. And consequently, they may tell pollsters what they're thinking in one sense, but they won't actually say what they're going to do. And frustration has been registered more than anything else in this refusal of Labour Party supporters to turn out for their traditional party. And it can even explain, I think, the punishing effect of people who have been loyal to Labour in large slices of the country doing what they did overnight here. They decided, although many of these constituencies, these districts that they live in, have been solidly Labour for generations, they have overnight gone conservative. And that is the most extraordinary thing. You're talking about what lies at the heart of all this. Well, I think that is one of the major shifts that we're observing here. The tribal loyalty, which has sustained the Labour Party through decades, so a century now, is I don't know if it's going to be finally fragmenting, but this is certainly a major fragmentation. I could hear a small example, a town near where I grew up, in the same county, but far to the west and south, just south of the Scottish border, England's most northerly, on northwesterly county. It's a town called Workington, and it's exactly as the name suggests. It's a town of working people. And for as long as human memory can recall, it has been a Labour seat. And overnight, it is now a Conservative seat. And that goes for other places equally dyed in the wool. Rust Belt towns like Consett in the northeast, Redcar in Yorkshire, Burnley in Lancashire. These are part of the industrial belt of the north central England, and they've gone conservative too. And so there's much for Jeremy Corbyn to reflect on, and indeed, you know, a very good reason for him to have decided to go. Although, of course, he's trying to hold on as long as he can and influence the succession that will come after him.
Which yep. is going to be a question of how long. But before it gets, since nobody's called me, which I cannot fathom, before it gets overthought.
Well, we want to talk to you, Jill.
No. Well, I know that you do, but what I'm saying is we're going to go slightly big picture here. And I just wanted to ask you a question, and that is, frequently you have quoted the, I believe, founder of the Guardian newspaper.
C.P. Scott, they're not quite the founder, but a very, very influential editor
right. Who founded
days.
It?
Yeah.
Who founded that paper, do you know?
It was founded in Manchester. It was originally the Manchester Guardian. I can't remember the name of its actual founder, but C.P. Scott was probably its most influential editor in its formative years.
All right.
And the quote you're recalling that I'm very fond of, you're right, is that comment is free, facts are expensive. Yeah. The message for the media industry as a whole is once again, if you're economically challenged, as most media outfits are these days, and if you stretch your resources as thin as they can possibly go, what you will find is that your connection to the facts of any matter get worn very, very thin, and you'll end up using more and more of what cable television, for similar reasons, relies on far too extensively, which is just empty comment. The difference between comment and fact is actually, at its heart, purely, not purely, but it fundamentally is very economic.
But then there's another one, and that is about the how you assess the your readership or your listenership.
Oh, right. Oh, no. That's another quote that actually comes from my very first boss in television, not in newspapers.
All right.
Jeremy Isaacs, the man who went on not only to change the landscape of British television entirely by ushering in a whole new channel that had never existed before with a legislative mandate to be innovative. Can you imagine that? Commercial television with a legally ordered mission to be innovative. But he went on from that also to run the Royal Opera House. So a Renaissance man. But he made one stricture very clear to us who worked for him. He said, never underestimate the intelligence of your audience, but never overestimate their knowledge.
And with that, and that's why I say I just can't believe that anyone hasn't called me.
People weren't working on a factual basis.
Yeah, but
if they relied on the media, that is.
But it's not just that.
And the media themselves were not. You know, the heart of hearts were well aware of the fact that they knew they were not dealing with hard facts. But this was an emotional upswell in Britain.
And
that's what we've been seeing, and that's what swept the Tories to power.
And has anybody really looked at there's, after a while, people who just have to go about their daily, lives with, let's just say, reduced support, it happens in small towns here as well. You know, you get...
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah,
that tribal
thing I was talking about in the Labour's so-called red wall. The colours are reversed in Britain, by the way. Red is the Labour Party and blue is the Conservative Party. What's happening, and it's applicable to many parts of the United States too, is a sense of being left out, a sense of frustration at leaders just taking no account of what's going on in people's everyday lives.
And with that, so while I'm sure the great and the good and the smart and the whatever will debate the blue wall, the red wall, I, as I say, no one called, so maybe no one wants. But there is a huge aspect, I think, of people who have just basically said, hey, hello, over here. And I don't know that, I don't know that it's gone for, I mean, it's a big problem now. It's huge. But it's a lesson possibly for many public servants to reflect on, which is...
Absolutely. And it's an invitation to...
get back to work.
To politicians and ambitious people of all kinds to... who perhaps want to get into politics to advance their own egos and their own sense of power, to operate on the basis of offering themselves as major disruptors.
I have to.
Disruption is our response to frustration. And anyone who wants to, offer something programmatic, and then you get close to the word ideology, and then people get freaked out by that too. And that's what you end up with. And we've seen it in the United States, of course, with Trump. We've seen it very clearly now with Bojo in Britain. But we've also seen it in places like Hungary.
We're going to call him
Hungary.
Alex now.
Al, yeah, right. And I think that you're right in saying that there is a big picture in play here. And we're getting a very pointed example of it in Britain. And, as many commentators have been saying, not always for the right reasons, but there are omens here for November 2020 in the United States.
Well, It's interesting you bring that up, because I was going to say, I never want to hear another American make fun of watching a parliamentary procedure that happens in England after what happened in the United States Congress yesterday, where 14 hours of obstruction by making changes to the charges that they knew were always going to be defeated. And then when things finally wrapped up at midnight, and they decided to take the vote the next day, one Republican congressperson said, "Well, you're only doing this because there's nobody watching now." Well, yeah, exactly right. It's meant to be open to the public to see, and the public is not expected to sit and languish through 12 hours of just attacks back and forth between each party. So the vote was put off to today, but it was shameful.
Yeah, official approval of the particular charges on which you are going to impeach your president. It's important enough to be seen by a daylight viewing audience.
It was just shameful what happened yesterday on attack. It was like watching a gone wild point-counterpoint skit from Saturday Night Live many, many years ago. Who could get the most arrogant punch in?
Dan, you misguided moron.
It was absolutely... I only saw clips. I kept going back because I like this one guy. I like Ari Melber. I like his show, right? It was embarrassing. That's all I can say.
I was watching Returns on ITV, and then I found C-SPAN was running BBC. But that's how I spent my evening and into the early morning.
I sort of posit my case on the prongs of this notion. Is it any surprise, given that kind of behavior on both sides of the Atlantic, by our representatives, people will vote in a cynical and disruptive way?
No, end of story. And does it need acres and acres of newsprint? No.
No, but
well, yeah.
But as I say, no one called.
So. But there are acres of newsprint to be filled.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens, because this country of ours is so hung up on
micro. It's like even, the granular. But how about some leadership? I'm sorry.
It's not even party. It's when people seem to decide on a candidate they like, the first thing they have to do is tear down any other candidate around it. Doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. People just, instead of saying, "This is who I like, I hope this person gets the nomination. If not, I'll make my decision there." Immediately, there's the tear down aspect, which comes into effect. You just can't let somebody else have an opinion without tearing down why they're wrong about their opinion.
And what's really fascinating about that, and you're entirely right, but what's absolutely fascinating is that is a media thing, whereas when you get into actual people, they look at this and they go, "I can't. You know, my kids are bad enough." And then they go back to what they're supposed to be doing.
And meanwhile, if I can put in one plaintive cry from the media corner over here, what happens to facts and truth?
And with that, you can say it again.
No, what happens to facts and truth?
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.